Hello, and welcome to Season 8 of the Canadian Women's Foundation podcast, All Right, Now What? Gender equality and justice, where we live, work, learn, and play, is the goal, and it makes life better for everyone. All Right, Now What? Remains a space where we ask, how do we move from awareness to action? But this season, we're also shifting the story. Through powerful storytelling, expert interviews, and bold conversations, we'll explore what true equity can look like, especially for those who are too often silenced or overlooked. The work of the Canadian Women's Foundation and its partners takes place on traditional First Nations, Inuit, and Métis territories. We are grateful for the opportunity to meet and work on this land. However, we recognize that land acknowledgements are not enough. We need to pursue truth, reconciliation, decolonization, and allyship in an ongoing effort to make right with all our relations.
Hi, I'm Shagani Hampram from the Canadian Women's Foundation. On today's episode, we're joined by Paul Taylor, an anti-poverty activist, educator, and social justice leader, whose work demonstrates how values-driven leadership and bold action can create meaningful change. In our conversation, Paul shares his experiences leading Food Share Toronto and running for Member of Parliament. He reflects on the lessons learned about equity, community, and the power of collective action. We'll also hear how the activism of Black women, like his grandmother and mother, have influenced his approach to leadership rooted in care, using resources to lift others up rather than compete against them. And finally, Paul offers practical insights on how we can all leverage the power and influence we hold in workplaces, communities, and beyond to advance justice and build a future where everyone has access to opportunity and dignity. I want to hear how you got into that. What was your journey into the food security space?
You know, when I reflect back, I think it actually started years and years ago. It started with my childhood experience. I was raised by a single mom. We were materially poor, which meant that we sometimes had to do without, you know, and including doing without food. And I still remember, actually, how everything would transform in our household when we had groceries. You know, we were singing while we cooked. We were dancing. And it was an escape from the pain that was, you know, being unable to access the food. The pain or maybe even the violence of being unable to access food. And I think one seminal moment for me was there was an election in 1993 in Ontario that I'll never forget. I was 13 years old. And I was paying attention for the first time to this election. And one of the candidates spoke about things like a common sense revolution. That was the platform. But one thing that really struck me and my family was after the election and the party was elected, one of the first things they did was they cut welfare by 22%. And that had a profound impact on my family. We were dependent on the meager amounts that social assistance provided. And we had certainly had less food, more stress in the household. And for me, I couldn't wrap my mind around why a leader in our province would want to make it harder for my family. So as I sat with this, talked to my mother, talked to others, I learned that like there were systems that actually kept people in poverty or foisted people into poverty and then kept them into poverty. So I think my journey started really with being curious about how to challenge those systems. And as an adult, learning about the right to food that we all have in this country and that we've had since 1976, for me has been an important kind of ground foundation for how I approach work around challenging food insecurity. And maybe one more thing, actually, I have to add that's really important to me. You know, I want to pay homage to my grandmother. She grew up and lived in her entire life in a tiny island in the Caribbean called St. Kitts. And one of the things she used to do is she believed that everyone needed had a right to food, you know, and she would feed as many children in the community, in her community, as she possibly could. Even someone that went on to become the Prime Minister of St. Kitts was one of the children that accessed meals with my grandmother, Maisie Olivia Baker Burt. And I think about how proud she would be of the incredible opportunity that I had to be able to work at Food Share alongside an incredible team to support people to access food and to challenge those very systems that kept people from food and continue to keep people from food.
Speaking about
this wonderful childhood you speak of, where, you know, there wasn't a lot, but yet it felt very full of love and joy, and what you learned from them about community, collective care. And so I am curious to hear what you did learn from them about activism, not just from your mother and your grandmother, but Black women in general, and how you think that has informed the way you lead in your various roles.
Absolutely. I think about women like, you know, certainly women in my family, but I think about Black leaders like Debbie Douglas. I think about Black leaders like Amaponsa. I think about Ohima Boateng, you know, Black leaders that are, Black women leaders that are really shifting the dial. And I've learned just so much also from watching them and been, you know, really taken aback by seeing some of the similarities of how my mother and grandmother moved. You know, it's really about, I think, a fundamentally different approach to leadership. It's about taking care of each other, using the limited resources that we have access to take care of each other, versus this other kind of idea of leadership that, to me, is about, you know, it's rooted in patriarchy, it's rooted in colonialism and white supremacy and capitalism, that's about winning against each other. You know, and that's where the competition really, really is fueled. And it's not really about supporting one another. We used to, you know, look at our neighbor, and if our neighbor were struggling, I think about my grandmother, and she did all that she could to support her neighbor, even though she didn't have a lot. Now, you know, we see our neighbor sometimes as our competition. They've got a nicer car than we do. We've got to then, you know, do whatever we need to do to get that nicer car. But I've really learned, you know, that it's really about, like I say, using the resources that we have access to, especially when we're in leadership or we have access to some resources, to be able to help as many people as possible. So that's really, you know, what I've learned about leadership, and it's really been central to me in being a leader, whether in any organization that I've ever worked in. I think about the mutual aid that in particular Black women and many racialized families have had to depend on in order just to survive. And I think my family wouldn't have survived if it wasn't for the support, the kindness, the thoughtfulness, and the leadership of Black women and other racialized women that my mother knew. And one thing, you know, one of the first things my mother said to me when she found out that I was going to, you know, be an executive director when I first became one, she asked me what that was. And I explained, you know, some of the points on the job description. And she said, you know, something very profound that's always stuck with me. And it's that it's only lonely at the top if you don't take other people with you. And I think that is a key value that I've certainly embraced as a leader. It's about how to, again, not only using resources, but how do we leverage our power so that others can access power and that others are growing and building. To me, that's really important. And I think too many organizations are really built on, you know, exploitation of their people, not building up their people, not finding, you know, using their resources to support healthy lives for their colleagues. So for us, you know, that's really critical. It's about, you know, designing systems, policies, and approaches based on that value, you know. And it's very different than focusing solely on the profitability of a business, which to me, you know, really breeds oppression and the exploitation of workers and burnout, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I'm fortunate to work with people that believe that business can be designed sustainably if we start focusing on the people in the business, not just trying to make as much money as possible, grow our, and when it comes to charities, growing our impact as much as possible, building careers for one person. No, it's really about how do we design our whole organization in a way that places people at the center, the people that are doing the work and the people that we're collaborating with or that we're serving or working with or who are benefiting from the services of our organization. Those are the people that we feel should be centered, not board members from Bay Street necessarily, not funders necessarily. It's about the people. So for us, that's a key value. And I have to say that is one of the things that I've learned from women like my mother, Bernadine, my grandmother, Maisie, and my great-grandmother, Rebecca.
The hard part of being muted is you can't hear my humming and nodding for each time you say something. Like, I loved what your mother said about, you know, it's only lonely on at the top if you don't bring people with you. And that's so powerful. And it's such a powerful reminder of, again, the why you're doing something and who you're bringing along on that journey. And I am curious, this was not one of the questions I sent you, but speaking of your mother, I am curious what she thought of when you decided to run for MP, because that was something else that I feel is worth noting, because you did run for MP at Parkdale High Park twice. And, you know, you like to mention, and I think it's worth mentioning, that you only lost by, I think, 1,000 votes, which is very close. So how did she feel about you taking that step as well to try to make an impact? And I think that's a lovely connection to the story you told earlier about, you know, when you, the election that happened, that you saw such severe cuts. I can imagine you were really driven to one day kind of, you know, make sure the opposite happens. So how did your mother feel for you taking that step into politics?
Interesting. Well, I will tell you a short story to tell you, introduce you to a little bit more to my mother and her thinking on politics and me and where I was going. I was in high school and I spent some time, you know, getting involved in trying to understand again, since, you know, after I was 13 and after that election, trying to understand politics a little bit more. I got involved doing a little bit of work and some meetings with our local member of provincial parliament for my high school. And oddly enough, many years later, he went on to run for mayor. And he was at an event that the organization, I was running a homeless youth shelter, he's the ED there, and my mother was at this event, and he said to her, "You must be so proud of Paul." And then he kind of walked away to mix and mingle with the crowd. He introduced himself and said, you must be so proud of Paul. And my mother was quite taken aback. I wasn't sure why, but she was quite taken aback. And then I was quite taken aback when I saw my mother, you know, walking up behind him and tapping him on the shoulder and saying, "Well, excuse me. You know, I expect great things from Paul. Paul is, you know, gifted." And she said all kinds of wonderful things. And she said, "If you're not careful, he'll take your job as well." So, you know, this was before I had any idea, any inclination that I would ever be on a ballot. But my mother, you know, I think it's what Black women often have to do when it comes to raising children. It's challenging the low expectations of others. You know, what she felt in talking to her later was that he was saying, "You know, Paul wouldn't have amounted to much. You must be so proud of him being an executive director." So, you know, I think what my mother was responding to, yeah, is challenging those low expectations and saying, "No, excuse me, Paul's destined for great things. And I expect nothing but that." While at home, she was saying to me, "Paul, if you want to collect garbage and pick up rocks and that's what makes you happy for the rest of your life, that's what you need to do." And I'm so grateful for receiving that kind of messaging. I never had any pressure to, you know, to do any of the things that I'm doing now. So it doesn't come from that I've done in the past. It doesn't come from a place of pressure. It comes from the kind of boldness and curiosity that my mother has inspired in me. And also, you know, she really inspired in me the importance of being a part of the change that I want to see. So, yeah, I think my mother was pretty pleased, but also not surprised when I told her that I was going to be running to be a member of parliament. And she, just as bold and courageous, I'll never forget, we hosted an event and the leader of the party was in the community. And my mother walked right up to him and said, "You better work hard around housing. People are depending on you." I was incredibly embarrassed. But, you know, that's my mother. And that's me. So I'm pretty proud of her, pretty proud of me. And yeah.
That's absolutely beautiful. And it explains so much about you. And for sure, the way you're moving and doing this work. And this is where I want to kind of go back to Food Share, because I think... Food Share is very interesting because it's a way that I learned about you without knowing it was about you. I used to work at Sistering and we used to talk a lot about Food Share. And at a time where a lot of these changes were happening, for us, it felt quite radical, you know, to some of the changes we heard happening at an organization, paying for someone's time at an interview, as one example. Just it was so radical and powerful to us. And we really looked at Food Share as an example of where we also wanted to move and try to get our organization to move towards. And so it was only now later that I can make the dots. And I was like, "Oh, that was during the time you were executive director." And so I want to talk about that because I think one thing I really respect about you is exactly what I mentioned that came through in your keynote, which is, you know, you want to make an external impact and serve communities, but there's also quite a prioritization on internal impact and how you're treating employees and how you're focusing on their well-being. And so Foodshare, for example, I think, you know, made an announcement. I don't know if that was during the pandemic, but had ensured that every employee would be paid a living wage, which, you know, seems so obvious, but yet it's always surprising when you realize a lot of organizations haven't taken that step yet. There's so many other things with, you know, salary transparency. And so I want to hear, when you reflect on that time, what are you the most proud of in terms of some of the changes you brought during your time there? And when we think of, you know, their nonprofit leaders who might be interested in making some of these changes in their organizations that might feel radical, quote unquote, what advice would you give to them when they're approaching it?
Maybe the first thing I'll say is, you know, I so appreciate everything you just shared. But with that, I also think it's sad that, you know, we see, you know, the approach that my colleagues and I took as radical. That, you know, paying someone for their labor of attending an interview when they often have to do tons of research, spend time, taking time off work to attend the interview, to do that research, finding childcare, paying for transportation. You know, that we live in a society that has allowed this to happen, and employers, you know, just ignore that labor, to me is incredibly sad. So I think I'm most proud of pushing back on, like, working with my colleagues to be curious and to push back on the ways that we've been taught that organizations should work, the way that leadership works. I have to say, I'm also incredibly proud, you know, before George Floyd was murdered, Foodshare was talking about white supremacy and colonialism, you know, and I think, again, shouldn't be radical. Like, these are real things. Patriarchy, white supremacy, colonialism, capitalism, these are oppressive organizing principles that are so incredibly deeply embedded in just about every system that if we're not talking about them, what are we doing? How are we doing the work if we're not talking about things like white supremacy? So I'm incredibly proud for centering those kinds of conversations as we talk about food insecurity. I'm incredibly proud of partnering with a group out of the University of Toronto, working with folks like Valerie Tarasic, a group called Proof. And we did some research that really demonstrated what many of us already knew, to be quite honest. But I think what it did is it also challenged, you know, white universalism in addressing issues that disproportionately affect racialized people, and in particular, Black and Indigenous people. There are so many white leaders leading organizations, and if they're big budget organizations, they're more likely to be white men. But there are so many white leaders leading organizations that deal with our issues, and they refuse to step aside. They refuse to meaningfully engage us. So I'm really happy that, and proud of some of the work that my colleagues and I did to help change the conversation about how, you know, resources are deployed to address issues like poverty and food insecurity. You know, we really feel that those resources should be deployed in ways that really allow the people who are most affected by the issue to direct their deployment. You know, I think about my grandmother, who had no grants, no funding, or no institutional support, but a wealth of knowledge, community connection. You know, if she was backed by an institution, if she was the executive director of an institution that was tasked with challenging food insecurity might be where it belongs in the history books in St. Kitts and probably in other countries that would have been inspired by that work. So, you know, and the sad reality is that if my grandmother was alive today doing what she did back then, I'm almost positive that what she would be invited to do is she'd be invited to speak on a number of panels and maybe podcasts like this about her commitment to feeding her community, but not compensated appropriately for her experience and knowledge. And that is something that's systemic and is again, buttressed by racism and white supremacy and patriarchy. We're not recognizing the vast labor, knowledge, and experience of Black women and other racialized women. And things would change profoundly if we did that. I want to just pick up one last piece in relation to your initial question, you know, what should people focus on in terms of advancing change? I'm a real believer in looking at the board of directors. You know, I think often organizations have this idea that we need to have rich, well-connected people on the boards. Well, often that means rich, well-connected white folks, and not people with lived experience of the issues that, we're working on. And I'll tell you, FoodShare, one of the most important things that was, that helped advance the change is we had people with lived experience of the issues that we were working on our board of directors. It's much easier to support someone to acquire governance skills if they don't have them, or if this is their first time on a board, than it is to help somebody who doesn't have lived experience understand the issue. So, you know, when it came to conversations about becoming a living wage employer, introducing a top-up for workers that were delivering food in the pandemic, it was a no-brainer. They said absolutely, because these were people who were delivering food during a pandemic. These were people who have navigated poverty, food insecurity, anti-Black racism, and anti-indigeneity, as opposed to trying to convince a bunch of rich white folks to do the right thing. And also, that's not where I see myself spending my energies. I want to work with folks willing to do the work, willing to be bold and really understand the issues that we're trying to address, and are willing to reach for bold solutions and call for bold solutions to address those issues. So starts the board of directors.
You are currently co-founder of Weekends and Evenings Consultancy. Love the name. And it is described as a values-driven consultancy. And I want you to talk a little bit more about what that means. What does it mean to be values-driven in practice? And why do you think there is a barrier for many nonprofit organizations from continuing and committing to being values-driven in practice?
I think what it means, you know, for us at Evenings and Weekends Consulting to be values-driven means that's where we start. It's not an exercise that, you know, a few people go off and work on a weekend, you know, and then it goes on a website and it sits there and nobody revisits it. It's actually where we start and we revisit those values every day. First of all, that's our basis of unity. You know, when we're engaging people for our team, you know, they have to align with those values. Otherwise, it's not a good fit. So it's our basis of unity. So that's what we come back to. And what it means is it means coming back to our basis of unity, but also designing systems based on our values, designing policies and procedures based on our values. It's one thing to have these values. It's another thing to see them not reflected anywhere in your policies or procedures or your approach. So for us, you know, things like having a ratio that connects what the highest paid and the lowest paid person in the organization. You know, for us, we have a ratio of 1-3. It's the same ratio that existed at FoodShare. So which means that the highest paid person can make no more than 3 times what the lowest paid person makes. It means transparent wage grids. We have it on our website. It means things like centering rest and joy. So we have an unlimited vacation policy. We are a 4-day work week organization. So today's my Thursday. I am elated. I won't be working on Friday. It also means no work after 5 or before 9, because we're not paid for that time and we're not volunteers. It means the benefits start on day 1. It means providing days for our colleagues to volunteer to do things that help advance justice outside of some of the work that we might be doing. And it also means saying no to work that doesn't align, or saying no to working with people that don't align. I think that's what it means for us to live our values. And I think it's hard for a lot of organizations, because we have been convinced that things like waiting 3 months for benefits is inevitable. We've been convinced that things like a ED of an organization or a CEO of an organization making hundreds or thousands times what the lowest paid worker is paid, we have been convinced that that's inevitable. So I think it requires a fundamental shift. I'm so grateful to my mother for inspiring curiosity in me. She always, if I had a question, she was, you know, supporting me to figure it out. And I think that's what we all need to do. We need to embrace curiosity a little bit more. We need to think about the lives that we want to live, the communities that we want to live in, and the role that we want to play in creating those communities, and the power that we have access to in creating those communities, and get on with leveraging that power and those resources to create those communities. It's one thing to sit and rail and complain about the ills of capitalism, the ills of white supremacy, and post, you know, solidarity statements and anti-Black racism statements, but those are toothless. And if you're not willing to accompany your work around racial justice with economic justice, you know, then you're not doing racial justice work. You're just having a nice conversation, or you're building a brand, or you're, I don't know what you're doing, but, you know, we don't have time for that anymore. I think for me, I'm really committed, and my colleagues are equally as committed to recognizing, one, we recognize the urgency of these issues, but also, as a result of recognizing that urgency, the imperative to get on with it.
You know, this work has highs and lows. I can imagine there's days that, you know, you read the news and it can feel like there's, you know, progress is going backwards instead of forwards. It can feel hard sometimes to get up and keep doing this. And so I would love to hear what right now is giving you hope and what keeps you motivated in doing this important work.
Oh, I love that question. Thank you for that. So maybe I'll just say one thing really quickly before I answer that question that's maybe a little less hopeful. And I just want to acknowledge this, you know, because I've received a fair bit of attention, acknowledgement, and kudos for advancing these policies. And I spend a lot of time talking with folks like this about these kinds of policies. And I just want to acknowledge that, you know, in terms of my approach, I think it's inefficient to try to use my energies to convince leader after leader after leader to embrace, you know, the types of policies that workers deserve. So I don't think it should depend on a benevolent leader or a leader that gets it. I think we need to have these things enshrined in policy. So my intention is really to inspire people to demand more of our elected officials, because I think that's another critical piece. So what gives me hope? You know, really the belief that better is possible. You know, I talked about my mom raising me to be curious, but she also raised me to believe that anything was possible and that I can be a part of making better possible. So as you mentioned earlier, you know, when I ran for MP with my mom by my side, you know, that was so special and important for me. And it must have been really special for her, because, you know, she would be seeing that belief that she taught me, you know, live alive inside me. You know, as you mentioned also, she has since joined the Ancestors about 6 months ago. And, you know, what gives me hope and what inspires me is realizing that I have a responsibility to run as far as I can with the baton that she and others have passed on to me. And the other thing that gives me hope and inspires me is that I get to hold that baton alongside incredible people, whether it's my business partner, Leticia Esartel, or Rudena, or Daniel Serra, or Kate, or Kiko, or Daniela. You know, we're working together to advance change that we all know is possible. And to me, that feels like the work that I was meant to be doing. And when we get the opportunity to do the work that we were meant to be doing, oh, it feels really good. And when we get to do it alongside people that feel the same, it's incredibly special. So that gives me hope. It also helps keep me accountable. It helps, it challenges the loneliness of sometimes advancing this kind of change when you get to work with people that get it and that want to see that change as much as you do. So I feel very, very fortunate and very, very pleased to be able to be in the position that I am now.
Thank you for helping shift the story on safety, leadership, justice, power, and rights. You can visit CanadianWomen.org today to learn more and stay connected. We believe everyone should be able to exist without fear of harassment or abuse. You can help make that a reality. Text SAFE, S-A-F-E, to 20222 to give $10 and support women, girls, and gender diverse people throughout Canada. Small actions can lead to big changes. We appreciate your support.